Welcome. I'm Mark Hertzgard, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today, and this is Your Call's regular Friday Media Roundtable. On today's show, we're focusing on a couple of things: the state of the news media in Mexico following the assassination of a giant of Mexican journalism, Javier Valdez. Mr. Valdez did exemplary reporting on the drug trade in Mexico and the government's complicity in that drug trade with the drug cartels. He was assassinated on May 15th. We'll also be looking at conditions for migrant workers who leave Mexico and travel north to work on California's farms, and the impact that President Trump's proposals on NAFTA and a possible border wall may have on California's agricultural industry. And finally, later in the show, we'll look at the ongoing labor conflict with the media giant AT&T, including the strike that occurred in 36 states across the United States over the weekend. Happy to say that today we are joined by two excellent journalists. First, joining us from Mexico City, Kate Linthicum. She's the correspondent for the Los Angeles Times in Mexico. Kate, welcome to the show. Are you with us, Kate? We will keep working on that and get back to her shortly. Here in the studio with me is David Bacon. He's a writer and a photographer, a correspondent for In These Times newspaper. He's got a new book that looks fabulous. It's called In the Fields of the North, or in Espanol, En los Campos del Norte. It is a book that documents the experiences of migrant farm workers in California. He's also been covering the AT&T strike for In These Times. David, very good to have you here at KLW.
Good morning, Mark.
And have we got Kate on the line yet, or is that still not working? We're working on that. We've had a fall on the line, but we will get to that shortly. And we do start every show, as regular listeners of the Friday Media Roundtable know, we start every show trying to look at the positive side and congratulating, singling out some of the better work done by our fellow journalists in the past week. And, of course, I think we've been reminded here in the United States just yesterday of the difficult situation that faces a lot of journalists now. In Montana, a congressional candidate assaulted a journalist for the Guardian newspaper for asking a question that the candidate didn't like, and that candidate nevertheless was elected. Yesterday, the people of Montana, in their wisdom, decided that that candidate should go to Congress. So we are especially glad to be able to do this show for you today and to single out some of the great work that has been done by journalists, and especially the brave work in Mexico. But first, David Bacon, why don't you tell us, what was the piece that struck you this week as a nice piece of journalism?
Well, I have a couple of thumbs up, Mark. Being a labor reporter myself, I wanted to, first of all, give a shout-out to Stovey Hurwitz, who wrote a piece for The Nation about a very interesting situation that developed in Missouri, in Hazelwood, Missouri, where students became very concerned about their teachers. Their teachers were trying to negotiate a union contract with the school district. The school district refused to negotiate. So the students walked out in defense of the teacher. The school district suspended 200 students 6 days before the end of the term, which meant that they couldn't take their finals, which meant that they wouldn't graduate. So the ACLU, local churches, and the teachers themselves kind of had to bargain with the school district to get the students back into the class, which they did, but they had to pay a price. The teachers paid quite a high price, and that was the school district insisted they agree to a contract with no wage raises and that had additional days of work without, you know, any compensating pay for it. So in other words, essentially they had longer work, less pay, but they were very loyal to their students. And I thought it was a really great story because it's very kind of grassroots labor story, which I think is what makes labor reporting exciting, but also because it shows teachers and the community kind of working in defense of each other. And we hear a lot these days about teachers and the community in opposition to each other, especially from the administration, Betsy DeVos. And I think this was sort of a much more real picture of what actually takes place. And the other shout-out I want to give is to Harold Meyerson, who's been doing labor reporting and writing about the economy for a lifetime. And Harold had a really good one that I don't think that the media really should picked up on in the way it really deserved. And that was that the He reports that the Congressional Research Service did a survey which correlated rising income inequality with inequality in terms of the lifespan of people. And what it showed was that if you were born in 1930, if you were in the 20% richest people in the United States, you could expect to live 5 years longer than people who were in the bottom 20%. However, if you were born in 1960, rich folks essentially lived 12 years longer than poor folks. And that was for men. For women, it was even more so. It went from 3.9 years, or basically 4 years, to over 13 years. And so what Harold says in his article about this, he says, first of all, to have been born in 1930 means to have spent young adulthood and middle age in the one period in U.S. history when median income rose steadily. In other words, that's why that differential was low during that period. And then he says, for most Americans, the presidency of Ronald Reagan and the rise of global capitalism ushered in an age which we have yet to exit of stagnant incomes and, for many Americans, stagnant or declining lifespans.
Okay, and Harold's piece was where?
And Harold's piece was in the American Prospect.
American Prospect. We will have both of those pieces, of course, on our website. I just want to add, I am the investigative editor at The Nation magazine. That was not a special plug for The Nation, but I was very happy to see that piece as well. And I think we have Kate Linthicum now on the phone from Mexico City. Kate, can you hear me?
I can. Hi.
Great. Thanks for joining us. We're very glad to have you. Could you begin with a piece of journalism that you want to give a shout-out to this week?
Sure. I really liked this New York Times story on Jared Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law, looking at his real estate company that it turns out has a number of minimum, like Section 8 and other low-income housing around the country. And he's been basically a slumlord, this investigation revealed. And there are a number of just examples of these really frivolous lawsuits that his company has filed against its former tenants, making their lives hell. And it just seems to me a really good example of this kind of vetting that we really didn't do on Kushner, because he wasn't running for office, but he finds himself sort of in the White House in a very prominent position of power, and so now there's been a number of articles looking at, you know, everything from his tax filings to how he's grown his companies, but it's really important to give a clearer picture of this person who has increasing amounts of power, it seems, in the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm. That's in the New York Times, and we'll have that linked as well, of course, on the KLW website. So let's talk now about Mexico. I must say, as a journalist here in the United States, I am frankly in awe of our colleagues there, including you, Kate, who are working in such a dangerous situation. I was struck in researching this program today that the data from the Committee to Protect Journalists, which is an excellent organization based in New York City that protects journalists around the world, they keep data on how many journalists die in the course of our work around the world. And it is striking that Mexico, since 2011, Mexico has the highest rate, higher than Syria, where there's an ongoing fighting war, higher than Iraq, higher than Afghanistan. And the assassination on May 15th of Javier Valdez is a bitter punctuation mark on that. I just want to read quickly from a piece that appeared in the Guardian newspaper by a colleague of his who talked about the murder of Valdez, and he called it, quote, shockingly deliberate. Javier was shot 12 times at 12 o'clock noon outside the offices of his magazine Rio Doce, which in Spanish means River 12. His killing tells us that no one is untouchable in Mexico, unquote. Kate, you're there in Mexico City. You work in Mexico. Talk a little bit about Javier Valdez, and it seems to me he's a giant of Mexican journalism, no?
Yeah. I mean, universally respected as a great journalist, a great investigative journalist who wrote stories exploring sort of the changing landscape of narcos here in Mexico, and also increasingly wrote about sort of the links between, you know, the criminal groups and the politicians, which is really the most dangerous nexus, it seems, for journalists here. Javier worked a lot with our newspapers. He was an incredible colleague. He was someone you could call at any time and ask for the latest news of what was going on in Sinaloa, and he would take the time and explain his very astute take on sort of the latest in terms of politics and narco-politics. And he was an incredible journalist who had also written on this topic. He wrote a book called Narco Periodismo, which is basically narco-journalism. He was sort of a symbol of this class of Mexican reporters that perseveres despite very, very scary risks.
It's really astonishing, the perseverance. Apparently at Mr. Valdez's funeral, his brother spoke, and he said that, you know, I asked my older brother a couple times, why does he do this work? Isn't he afraid? And Valdez replied, according to his brother, of course I'm afraid. I'm a human being. But somebody needs to do this work. That kind of bravery is just really stunning. And, you know, here in the United States, of course, we look askance at what happened to our colleague, another Guardian newspaper reporter, who was literally assaulted by a congressional candidate the other day in Montana. And yet the level of risk in Mexico is completely quantum levels different. So, Kate, as you're there in Mexico, do you feel like a target? Do you feel, of course, you're working for an American, North American newspaper, but do you feel like a target as a journalist?
So I there's a sort of uncomfortable immunity that foreign reporters seem to have here, and even national reporters covering, you know, Mexican reporters covering Mexico from Mexico City. For some reason, the vast majority of the people who have been attacked or killed here in Mexico have been regional reporters, local reporters. And I think it's because the kind of work that, you know, a foreign correspondent does in Mexico is sort of broader. I'm talking in my stories about these bigger trends, and I'm not so focused on exposing the, you know, exact links between the mayor of the small town and the cartel leader there, because we just sort of take a more meta view. The local investigative reporters, the local crime reporters, that's exactly what they're doing, and I think that's where it gets so dangerous, because they're like naming names within the context of a town, you know, in a newspaper that everyone in that town reads. So it's much more dangerous for them. So it's this sort of uncomfortable immunity we have. But, you know, Mexico is an increasingly dangerous place generally, beyond just journalists being murdered. So that is sort of the context you're always reporting in.
That's Kate Linthicum with the Los Angeles Times. David Bacon with In These Times. You wanted to make a point.
Well, I just also wanted to remember somebody who was killed last year, Marco Hernandez, who was a reporter for Noticias. And Noticias, you might remember, is the newspaper, the daily newspaper in Oaxaca. The government shut it down in 2006. During the big insurrection there for basically being critical of the government. And what Marcos would write about was community resistance to resource extraction projects. In one case, the building of a dam that the community opposed, but there are also mining projects in Oaxaca. And because they're so tied intimately with the government, that to oppose a project not only means that you oppose a private company that's involved in developing it, but you're opposing the government. And as Kate says, the link between the government and these organizations, whether it's the narcos or whether it's companies that are involved in mining, for instance, that is the dangerous point. And that's what really got Marcos killed was covering that nexus. And also just one other point. You know, Mexico City used to be the place where you could go in Mexico and you didn't have to worry about it. That was until a fellow photographer, Ruben Espinosa, who was reporting and taking pictures in Veracruz, which is one of the most dangerous states in Mexico to be a journalist, went to Mexico City, basically fleeing Veracruz, and his death followed him, and he was assassinated in the street in an apartment in Mexico City. So Mexico City is not as safe. In fact, there's really no place in Mexico that is really safe for the people who are doing this kind of work.
That's David Bacon with In These Times. You're both raising a point here that I'm struck by here. One of the things that Javier Valdez talked about as well, too, which is this intersection between the drug cartels and the state, the government, whether at local, regional, at federal level in Mexico. One-third, according to the Committee for to Protecting Journalists, more than one-third of the attacks on Mexican journalists are carried out by government, military, or police officials. It's not all the drug cartels, folks, who are doing this. And Valdez had a quote where he said that really the government is more journalist and more dangerous to journalists than the narcos are. He said, quote, "The political class in Mexico is where it is because narcos protect it. They finance their campaigns. They put them up as candidates. And that's why it's so dangerous." So, Kate, when you're there covering a story in Mexico, do you take special precautions when you're going outside of Mexico City to report on one thing or another?
Yeah, certainly, especially in, I mean, the violence in Mexico is so concentrated in certain states and certain communities. And in those places, yeah, you have to be very aware of the potential for violence from drug cartels or criminal groups, but also potentially from the government.
And so what do you do? And do you have bodyguards?
I mean, it depends on the context. Often we work with local reporters like Javier, who are, you know, really, really well-sourced and have a better sense of what is a safe thing to do and what is an unsafe thing to do. So that's one of the reasons why his death is so hard, because he's done that kind of work for so many foreign journalists in the past. But I think that point that you're making, that there's this totally accepted at this point understanding that there's so much collusion between local politicians especially and the narcos. I mean, the federal government's response to this was 10 years ago to send in soldiers into the streets of Mexican communities to try to fight this, because there was this sense that, like, local police forces, state police forces, in many cases were just completely in the pocket of the narcos. That strategy continues today. We're seeing really no results, no positive results. Murder rates are poised this year to be higher than they have been in any year since 97, when the government started releasing homicide statistics. So, yeah, I mean, there's a sense that the Mexican government really isn't getting at that core issue, which is corruption at the local level, and in many cases, collusion between the narcos and politicians and police.
And there's, of course, a big election coming up in Mexico. June 4, there'll be an election in Mexico State, which is right around Mexico City, that will carry a lot of implications for the federal election that's coming up later next year, the government of President Nieto. How much of the government corruption is going to play a part in that election there, Kate? Is that what people are worried about out in the streets, or is it the economic situation?
Yeah, you know, the conversation has tended to be more along economic lines, and also, you know, this is sort of a nationalist moment in Mexico. There's a lot of people who are just sort of tired after 2 years of being talked down to by now President Trump, and so there's sort of some space for more kind of populist national rhetoric, and so you're seeing that definitely at play in that election and possibly in the presidential race next year. You know, the leftist candidate, López Obrador, is sort of a national candidate, seems to have his best shot yet at becoming president.
We'll be watching that. David, you want to have a quick comment before we go to break?
Well, I think from my my experience in terms of reporting on the border as well, too, I think people are angry at the broken promises as well, too. And when Trump says that he wants to renegotiate NAFTA, and then the Mexican government says, no, we want to keep it, and you know, large Mexican corporations say, no, we like it, I think that that has leaves a very bitter taste for most people, because most people feel that actually their incomes have gone down in the period of time since the treaty's been in effect. And of course, it also led to enormous displacement and the migration of people here to the United States. We have 10% of the people of Mexico who live north of the border now, in large part as a result of both the treaty and the economic changes that have accompanied it.
10% of the Mexican population now lives in the United States.
That's right.
We're going to get to that in the second half of the show. I want to invite everybody to join the conversation. Here's the number. You know it, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And, of course, you can send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website at www.yourcallradio.org. For those of you just joining the show, I'm Mark Hertzgard, sitting in for Rose Aguilar this week. And this is Your Call. We podcast the show, of course, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And please, if you have a show idea for us, drop us a line there or call us at 866-798-8255. We'll be back shortly. We invite your calls, and we will be continuing our conversation with Kate Linthicum, the Los Angeles Times correspondent in Mexico, and David Bacon, a reporter for In These Times, whose new book is called In the Fields of the North, a photograph book about Mexican migrants coming up here to work in the United States, where we just learned 10% of the Mexican population now living in the United States, pushed out by the economic conditions in Mexico after NAFTA. I'm Mark Hertzgard. Stay with us.
This is Your Call on KLW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, it's Inflection Point with your host, Lauren Schiller. She'll be talking with Jessica Jin, who led protests last fall over the new campus carry gun law at her alma mater, the University of Texas at Austin. Her weapon of choice, a sex toy.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Hertzgard. This is Your Call, and it's the Friday Media Roundtable, where we are talking about Mexico and the brave, brave journalists in Mexico who are covering the drug trade there and the collaboration between the narco cartels and the government there. And this occurs in the backdrop of what just happened here in the United States this week, where a reporter for the Guardian newspaper was literally assaulted by a Republican congressional candidate, rather, in Montana. Greg Gianforte was charged with assault the day before the election, and then on Tuesday, the voters in Montana nevertheless elected Mr. Gianforte to represent them in Congress. And of course, many fellow journalists have made the point that this takes place in a country where the current president has actively promoted hatred of the media, where some of his supporters have called for the media, for journalists to be killed. You may remember there was a T-shirt that a Trump supporter wore at a rally in Minnesota back in November, and the words on that T-shirt read, "Rope, tree, journalist. Some assembly required." That's the attitude here among some people in the United States, and you can see the dangers of that kind of rhetoric when you look south of the border at what has happened now in Mexico. We've been talking about the assassination of Javier Valdez, a journalistic giant in Mexico, who was probably doing the most exemplary reporting on the narco cartels. So let's, while we wait for some calls to come in, let's talk a little bit. David, I want to pick up on this fascinating point you just made, that 10% now of 9 to 10% of Mexico's population is living north of the border here in the United States. Of course, Donald Trump has railed rather dramatically about that, says we're going to build a wall. But I think your point was that they're coming here because the NAFTA situation has created economic difficulties in Mexico. Well, a Trump supporter might say to you, well, yes, that's why we want to renegotiate. That's why the president wants to renegotiate this bad trade deal.
Well, renegotiate in order to do what? In the interests of who? You know, before NAFTA took effect in 1990, NAFTA took effect in 1993 and 94, about 4.5 million Mexican migrants were here north of the border. That number peaked at between 2008 and 2010 with about 12.6 million people. So that was an enormous flow of people coming north here. It's tapered off a little bit, but still there are a lot of people coming north for the same reasons that people have been coming north for quite a long time. Now, the people who came during that period of time, some of them came with visas, but there are not 12.6 million visas that are available for people to come from Mexico. And yet, first of all, people had reasons for coming that were very strong. In other words, poverty, the need to put food on the table for families. Also, people had families here, and so people wanted to live with their families, as we all do. So those people with visas came with visas, and those people who did not come with visas, who did not have visas, came nevertheless, which is one reason why we have now in the United States about 12 million people living here who are undocumented. And so if the Trump administration's answer to that is simply to deport all of those people, that would wreak economic havoc in the United States. You know, in the book here, in the Fields of the North, one of the reasons why I took the photographs and interviewed the people whose oral histories are in this book is to sort of put a reality check on this. First of all, we ought to know who the people are who are putting the food on our table. And in California and on the Pacific Coast, those people are Mexican. In fact, they have been Mexican for decades. But also, I think a certain human appreciation of people is in order. First of all, the photographs show the hard work that people do. Farm labor is difficult work. You're doing it outside. It's I think much more skilled than people give it credit for. It's not the case that anybody can do any job out there. Some jobs require a lot of training and a lot of knowledge to be able to do.
You're talking to somebody who grew up on a farm, so you're preaching to the converted here, I must say.
There you go.
I was struck also by, you know, you talk about a reality check. So many of the Central Valley districts voted Trump in November. And I think, Kate, you might correct me on this, I believe it was an LA Times story, went into the Central Valley in December and talked to some of the, you know, the growers, the big agricultural farm owners, and they were shocked to learn that their workers might be deported, and that they said, well, we didn't think he'd really do that. Should we be shocked, David Bacon?
Well, no, I don't think we should be shocked. I think that growers knew perfectly well who they were supporting when they supported Trump. And it wasn't just here in California. I've seen the same kind of Trump signs in the agricultural areas of Washington State, for instance.
But why would they cut off their nose to spite their face then? They had to know it was going to hurt their labor supply.
Well, I think that growers think that either the administration is not going to enforce the law very hard, and Trump has sort of sent some mixed signals. So there was a big grower meeting last week, for instance, with Trump in Washington, D.C. A lot of large growers came from California and the West Coast to meet with him. And so Trump said things like, well, we're not going to go after farm workers. Of course, he said he wasn't going to go after young people and DACA, what are called the DACA recipients or dreamers, and yet now we're seeing that he is, in fact, doing exactly that. But I think growers also were pushing for the expansion of contract labor programs, which they have wanted for a long time, which they have, but they want to be able to expand them.
Explain what that means.
Well, contract labor programs, especially, it's a visa program that is called H-2A. And what it means is that growers or their agents can go to primarily Mexico, but other countries as well, too. They recruit people to come and work in the United States. The people who come have to work for the grower that brings them. They sign a contract. And they can only stay and work for a period of less than a year, at which point they have to go home. So people in this is really kind of like the old Bracero program that people my age at least might remember we had during the 40s and 50s and 60s. In fact, the civil rights movement in the United States got Congress to abolish that program in 1964. And here we are going back to it. In fact, 164,000 people came to the United States last year on these H-2A visas. And so even though there are some restrictions on them, and growers want those restrictions eliminated, it's still for them, in some ways, a very kind of handy situation because the workers are not present in the United States other than when they're actually doing the work for the grower.
All on the grower's terms. We've got a call from Ken in San Francisco. Welcome to the show, Ken.
Yeah, hi. I always feel like these stories about murders in Mexico are covered discreetly and not as part of a system of bribery and corruption. If journalists are killed and judges are killed, and we know that the military and police are involved, those are agencies controlled by the government. How high does the corruption in Mexico reach? We, as Americans, hear about President Nieto, but really little else about the Mexican government.
Excellent point.
How bad is the corruption? Does it reach into the president's cabinet?
Excellent point. Ken, Kate, I know you have to leave us shortly. Can you tackle that one before you go, please?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the question that every journalist in Mexico wants to answer, and there have definitely been attempts to kind of prove that, to prove that you know, maybe the president isn't meeting with cartel bosses, but there's some maybe overlooking of criminal activity in certain parts of the country, or even that the Mexican government had sort of favored one cartel over others, perhaps even as an attempt to kind of make peace. So those are all very, very important questions and hard to answer. Also, they speak to the need for more investigative journalism here.
Did you ever talk to Javier Valdez about that? You know, what his theories were?
What was it?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you there.
Were you asking? I don't think Javier.
We seem to have lost Kate again here. We will. David, why don't you jump in here?
Sure. Well, you know, I mean, some of these connections are pretty not only well-known but very well-documented. The past governor of Veracruz, for instance, Javier Duarte, was very well-known to have been a collaborator with the Zeta drug-dealing gang, which is one of the reasons why so many murders have taken place in that state. The past governor of Quintana Roo was just arrested in Europe for extradition back to Mexico, where he's going to face charges of corruption as well. And the brother of one of Mexico's past presidents, Carlos Salinas de Gortari, his brother Raul Salinas, was widely viewed as being also very, very connected with drug gangs. So the problem is, as Kate said earlier, is that the cartels have a relationship with the political party, especially the PRI, the Party of the Institutional Revolution, which is the party that governed Mexico for most of its history, in certain states. And so if, for instance, Peña Nieto is the national candidate running for office and he wants to get votes from, you know, Mexico State, or he wants to get votes from Veracruz, well, those votes are controlled by this combination between the drug cartels or the political and party authorities in those states. So, yes, it's a very big problem. And as she said as well, too, it goes into the military itself. And we are now seeing, you know, mass graves discovered in Mexico where apparently the military has been murdering people itself.
Kate Linthicum of Los Angeles Times, I know you have to leave in a minute. You were about to make one last point.
I guess, I mean, coming back to the issue of journalists, there's been a lot of complaints here that the government just hasn't been focused at all on solving any of the crimes against journalists. I mean, I think over the last several years, there have been 800 serious assaults on journalists. You know, a handful of those cases actually saw someone brought to justice. So there's this sort of willful looking the other way that happens with the killing of journalists and just generally with crime in general. And so I think that it's all sort of linked back to that idea of even if politicians are maybe not, you know, directly involved with narcos here in Mexico, there is still this sense that the status quo perhaps benefits them, or that, you know, more daylight on sort of that just generally that more journalism and more understanding of the true connections is not a good thing for the politicians, and so they just sort of keep doing nothing.
That's Kate Linthicum. She is the Los Angeles Times correspondent in Mexico, based in Mexico City. Kate, we want to thank you very much for joining us today on Your Call Radio, and please stay safe.
Thanks.
We now have a call from Denny in Richmond, and we want to welcome you to the show. Hi, Denny.
Hey, great. David Bacon. Good to talk to you again. Remember Sawyer of Napa?
Oh, definitely.
Soaking the benzene in the leather jackets they sold.
Definitely.
Case that we did with you like 30 years ago. Great job doing this work on the Mexican journalists.
Thank you very much. And did you have a question about his book, In the Fields of the North?
Yes. And thank you very much for publishing that book. He's a fabulous photographer and journalist. And can I drill down to what really is the issue with the United States not dealing with you know, this issue in Mexico? Because it's you know, it's not a new issue, right, David?
Well, in terms of how we relate to Mexico as a country, you know, and thinking about the book and farm labor and sort of kind of making the connection there, in many ways, the agriculture industry here benefits from the flow of people coming from Mexico. That is the workforce. And also because people come here in a very vulnerable state. In other words, people coming, well, the Department of Labor says that about 53% of farm workers in the United States are undocumented, meaning that people are not in a very strong position to be able to insist on wages that would be higher than the minimum. Now, during the periods of time when we've had strong unions in agriculture, during the heyday of the United Farm Workers at the end of the 70s and the 80s, the base rate in agriculture in California was about 2.5 times the minimum wage, which if we still had the same ratio today would mean farm workers working at $25 or $30 an hour, which instead what we have is we have farm workers working at minimum wage. Basically, the minimum wage is the wage in farm labor. So
what is that for most Mexican farm workers who are here, regardless of their status? What are they making today?
Well, there was a survey done of what are called indigenous farm workers. In other words, farm workers who are coming from southern Mexico who speak languages, pre-Columbian languages like Mixteco and Zapoteco. In that survey, a third of the respondents, and we're talking about a workforce of about 165,000 people, about a third of those people said that they were making more than the minimum wage, about a third said that they were making the minimum wage, and a third reported that they were making less than the minimum wage. So that was a shocking statistic to me. Because
and that minimum wage is?
Well, minimum wage in California right now would be $11 an hour. So,
and that applies in the fields?
Yes, it does. You know, farm workers are covered, especially, well, California, we have fairly good, you know, farm labor laws in California, not just in terms of minimum wage, but recently the legislature in California passed a law that finally gave farm workers the same overtime rights that other workers have. In other words, time and a half after 8 hours in a day or 40 hours in a week. You know, farm workers, along with domestic workers, were written out of those laws when they were passed on a federal level in the 30s. And just this last year, farm workers won it, and domestic workers got their Bill of Rights passed through the legislature just a few years ago as well, too. So California is kind of trying to make up for these past omissions, shall we say. I think it's no accident that farm workers have always been people of color, as have been domestic workers. In other states, farm workers are not covered by those same overtime protection laws. So in Washington state, where I just was for the last couple of weeks, in Washington, people are also covered by the minimum wage. So they're making, again, Washington's minimum wage is pretty close to California, so it's around $11. But you can work on Saturday and Sunday, 7 days a week. You can put in 12 hours a day, and you're still going to be making straight time out in the fields.
Let's talk a little bit about Donald Trump's proposals and what they'll mean for the lives of these farm workers. Of course, he famously wants to build a wall. He famously insists that Mexico will pay for it. He inserted, I believe, $1.2 billion in his new proposed budget for building this wall. What's your take on that, David Bacon, of In These Times, in terms of what that will mean for the lives of these workers and, for that matter, for California's agricultural industry?
Well, one of the most important things that that wall and the enforcement regime that goes along with it means is that people cannot go home. So people, in many ways, are trapped here north of the border. Now, a huge number of people doing farm work in California, Oregon, Washington are coming from small towns in Oaxaca. Again, these towns have a very old and a very rich culture. In California, for instance, we have Oaxacan dance festivals called the Gelagues in many different places. So people are sort of practicing their culture here, and people are basically trying to build their lives here. But they've left their families behind. And so if your father or your mother dies and you want to go home for the funeral, or you want to go home and take care of them because they're sick, if you leave the United States and go back to Mexico, in order to come back here to your job, you might have to pay, for instance, a coyote to bring you across the border. Right now, the going rate on the border is about $6,000 or $7,000.
$6,000 or $7,000 to get
minimum
back
wage. You know, you're talking about 6 months worth of labor in order to be able
to deal with a family emergency back in Mexico.
That's right.
Let me invite our listeners to call in one more time here. The number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255, or, of course, email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We've been talking about the situation in Mexico with journalists covering the drug trade and also migrant workers there. We were joined earlier in the show by Kate Linthicum of the Los Angeles Times, and now here in the studio with me has been David Bacon of In These Times, and his new book is called In the Fields of the North, or in Espanol, En los Campos del Norte. It's a book of photographs and oral interviews with a lot of the farm workers who are putting the food on your table and that of many Americans. California, of course, is the source of about half of the fruits and vegetables that are sold in the United States. So we're going to have a few more minutes, yet, and we want to talk about the strike that's going on against the media giant AT&T. But join us, if you wish, 866-798-8255 here on Your Call Radio. So, David, we have just a few minutes. Let's talk about the AT&T strike, which maybe it's a coincidence, but one doesn't seem to hear very much about that in the mainstream media. Give us just the sort of the thumbnail of what's at issue here and why it's important.
Okay. Well, we had about 40,000 people who were working for AT&T who struck for 3 days this past weekend from noon on Friday to noon on Monday.
In 36 states.
Yeah,
All coordinated,
and all belonging to the same union, Communication Workers of America. And in the interest of disclosure, I also ought to note that I belong to the Communication Workers of America. In fact, I'm the head of the freelance unit for our local chapter of the Newspaper Guild here.
And being a good journalist, I'm sure you can also fairly summarize the company's position.
Sure. Well, there are contracts being negotiated between the union and AT&T. There are actually four different contracts that cover different kinds of AT&T employees. So one contract, for instance, covers what are called AT&T mobility workers. Those are the people who work in the retail stores and who work in the wireless division of the company. Another group of people work for DirecTV. They're technicians who work for DirecTV. Another group of people are the traditional telephone workers, so to speak, the people who take care of the lines and the hardware. So in these four contracts, the issues are surprising. Some of the issues are pretty much the same, and that is healthcare. People are trying to preserve their healthcare plans, and AT&T is asking that people agree to new healthcare plans that would basically cost the company less by moving a lot of those costs onto workers themselves. One of the big issues is what's called outsourcing. And this sort of manifests in two ways. One is that call centers, AT&T, I'm sure all of our listeners know about call centers, because the minute you have a problem with your phone or you have a problem with your computer, you call up tech support or you call up a call center and somebody, you know, tries to help you with it. Well, AT&T has relocated call centers outside the United States. And that has led to the elimination of about 12,000 jobs. And so,
not to mention the frustration of an awful lot of people on the customer end.
That's right. Well, depending on who you call and where you call, you can either get very good service or you can get very poor service. But there's no control over it in the hands of the workers themselves, because the conditions under which people are working in those countries is very different from the conditions that people are working in here.
So why should people who are not members of the Communication Workers of America, why should the average person care about this strike against AT&T?
Well, because what people are trying to preserve here is a kind of, I wouldn't say middle class, but kind of a life that I think most people in this country value. In other words, a secure job where you're not in danger of losing it, a job that has some medical benefits that go with it. That's become very important now with the discussions in Congress about whether or not Obamacare is going to be repealed and what's going to take its place. But we can all kind of see coming that defending your health care is going to be a really important issue. So essentially, if people are able to preserve that at AT&T, this giant corporation, I think that that's going to make it much easier for people in other kinds of jobs working for other companies to do the same thing. And conversely, I think that if people lose that, other companies are going to say, well, you know, the forces of the market, we can't control it. They couldn't control it at AT&T. We can't control it at our company, and your job is going to move somewhere else where we can pay
less. In the interest of fairness here, we do want to be fair. What is AT&T's position? What is their response to the union's arguments?
Well, it's very interesting. In terms of healthcare, they're just talking about the need for efficiency and the need for reining in costs. Now, you could argue that this is a company that makes $1 billion a month in profits, but still its purpose as a corporation is to make profits, and they're trying to protect that. In terms of the outsourcing, what's interesting about it is that they have not really presented information that would lead to some kind of a justification for the outsourcing. In fact, there were charges by the union at the National Labor Relations Board against the company for not providing the legally required information during bargaining that would allow people to understand, for instance, how many calls going to customer service or going to call centers at AT&T are being fielded here within the United States or are being fielded in other countries. And so that's important information to know if you're going to try and bargain over keeping those jobs in the U.S.
The fact that the National Labor Relations Board now reports to President Donald Trump, not a friend of labor, although a self-proclaimed friend of the working person, how is that going to affect this strike?
Well, I think any action before the National Labor Relations Board is going to become more difficult. You know, the National Labor Relations Board is a very political agency. During the Reagan years, for instance, it was very difficult for unions to get rulings out of the National Labor Relations Board. In fact, the Reagan administration became well known in the labor movement as being the administration that kind of legitimized the permanent replacement of strikers. And they got rulings, they produced rulings from the National Labor Relations Board that said that essentially if you went out on strike just over a wage increase, that your employer could permanently replace you and you had no job rights any longer. So that conceivably could be the tenor of rulings from the National Labor Relations Board under the Trump administration as well, too. So I think in the labor movement there's a lot of debate about how much to rely on the board and how much to rely on the legal process and how much to rely on the actions of workers at work, as, for instance, the people did at AT&T where they just, you know, went on strike.
We've got about 1 minute left. Can you just give us a quick preview of what the next steps are? I understand that negotiations continue between AT&T and the Communication Workers of America. What's the next step?
Well, I think negotiations exactly that. If those negotiations are productive, then the next step is that the union, the company sign a contract. If those negotiations don't go anywhere, I would imagine that there are going to be further job actions like the ones we've just seen.
And what does that mean for the customer?
Well, I think for the customer, what it means is that on the one hand, if the people at the store, at the mobility store, go out on strike, you're not going to get much service in a mobility store during the period of time when workers are out on the sidewalk. On the other hand, it's a chance to talk to those workers and find out what their beefs are.
What their beefs are.
There you go.
Yeah, well, there's plenty of beefs in Donald Trump's America. I think we can say that for sure. We're going to have to leave it there, folks. We've been speaking with David Bacon here in the studio. He is a writer and a photographer and a veteran union organizer. He's covering the AT&T strike for In These Times, and he's also the author of a terrific new book called In the Fields of the North, En los Campos del Norte, a book of photographs and oral interviews with the Mexican farm workers who do so much to put food on the table here in California and across the United States in the world's biggest agricultural economy here in California. And also before that, we spoke with Kate Linthicum. She's a correspondent for the Los Angeles Times in Mexico, joined us from over the phone from Mexico City. I want to thank everybody out there for joining us, for your emails and your phone calls. And please do send us your story ideas at KALW. You can write to yourcallradio.org. Your call is produced at KALW. And to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, just visit the website, yourcallradio.org. Ashleigh Krigbaum produced today's show. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And David Latulip is our studio engineer, bouncing around in the studio there. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Mark Hertzgard in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call.